This is Audible.
Dove Audio presents Edgar Cayce on the Millennium by Jess Stern, read by Elisa Bresnahan.
The prophets of doom and gloom are at it again. If El Nino and the sunspots don't get you, it will be the shift of the polar axis. Well, the polar axis has shifted before, and our precious Earth is still spinning around the sun at a dazzling speed. So what if it should hit the sun or get so close that we're toasted on one side and roasted on the other side? Gravitation. Of course, gravitation. The law of gravitation constraining the planets from colliding. And where did that come from? Obviously, the same source that rules our planet, our solar system, a greater solar system just discovered for the millennium, and all the other solar systems waiting to be discovered by our vigilant scientists. Doesn't it ever occur to any of the doomsayers that the same universal mind that pervades the planets has a hand in keeping us from falling off our spinning Earth, likewise has control of something like a polar shift, and will keep us from predicted icy or watery graves, if we remember to thank him for our being here at all? Yes, there is a God, the God of the universal mind and divine law, with whom the ancient prophets and Jesus Christ spoke and were spoken to. As Edgar Cayce knew so well, all of life is a testing ground as well as a learning process. For every dark cloud, there is a bright light of hope that we keep alive with our faith in a Lord who didn't give us life without hope. His greatest gifts, as Cayce noted, were that of love and free will. Free will by our actions and beliefs, our love for the parent Earth and all that is in it, to curb the turmoil in the bowels of the earth and the tides of the sea, and also keep us happily spinning around our sun at a breathtaking speed without falling off into space, because of the way the Lord crafted his universe. Cayce, a prologue. Edgar Cayce got to the core of life and living as no man since Jesus Christ. He told us what we were doing here on planet Earth, and why. Though he foresaw the future and clarified the past, he was more than a prophet or soothsayer, more than a healer of illness, for he showed the sick how and why they were sick, and how they could heal themselves with help from an abundant and bountiful nature. He taught us that we were children of the universe, and that we belonged here in this life, as we had in the past, and would again in the future. He saw each person as a unit of energy on the Earth, a creation of the universal force we call God, an entity distinct from every other being on the face of the globe who deserved to be treated as such. Thus, his suggestions and recommendations were invariably different for each seeker who came for help in body, mind, and spirit, for the material as well as the spiritual. He saw each man, woman, and child as an eternal being born into the earth plane for a purpose. And he pointed the way to the realization of that purpose. He sought not only wellness, but wholeness for the multitudes who presented their problems to him. Though more often than not, he tuned into a variety of these human problems from a piece of paper with only a name and address on it. He could tell at any designated hour if that person had left that particular place, whether it was home, a ship, or a hotel. He was asked to give a health reading for a habitually inebriated screen director, whiling away time in a game of bridge with three colleagues at the Savoy Hotel in London. In the midst of saying the director should be temperate in his habits, Cayce observed in a subconscious state back in his Virginia Beach study, "What a wonderful hand." The people monitoring his reading were puzzled. But in London, the director and his partner had notched a rare grand slam, a perfect hand in bridge. Cayce's mind could obviously travel through time and space at will to disperse information that led to innumerable cures and revelations. In his altered state of consciousness, his subconscious tuned into a universal intelligence that was like some vast computer network, supporting, if not clarifying, Einstein's postulation that there was no time or space in the real world. and his mind was the creator. In his sleep-like trance, Casey could place any cell in the body and tell why it was hurting, and what had to be done to ease the hurt, invoking remedies in nature for virtually every kind of disease, which, he said, was nothing more than dis-ease. He could look into the future on both a personal and grand scale. More than 60 years ago, he foresaw a tilting of the Earth's axis that would bring a global warming of the Earth only now being noted by environmentalists. A warming that he said will have considerable impact without the cataclysmic consequences predicted by the prophets of doom and gloom. He saw traces of an Atlantean civilization on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean near the Bahamas, where undersea explorations turned up fragments of man-made paving stones and marble columns washed over by the ocean for thousands of years. He peered psychically into the tombs and vaults of the ancient Egyptian pyramids and the Sphinx, referring to the lost records of an Atlantean incursion. And, incredibly, he saw the return of many Atlanteans by the millennium. Only recently, archaeologists confirmed his descriptions of the Egyptian structures and their secret chambers. Long before they were found, he described the precise location of the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel and described the contents and the biblical role of the Essenes with remarkable accuracy. Information of earth-shaking importance would flow out of him in response to the most trivial questions. A businessman, squeezed by World War II, inquired in 1941 when his business condition would improve. Casey replied in 4 years, August 1945, when the war would conclude with the defeat of the Japanese. He foresaw Hitler's rise and subsequent surrender, the month and year, at a time when the German dictator's armies sat astride all of Europe but the British Isles. He picked out a time frame, 1958 to 1998, the eve of the millennium, for the beginning of great eruptions in the bowels of the Earth, reflecting the human turmoil on its surface. He pinpointed the Great Alaska Quake in 1964 and more recent quakes in San Francisco and Los Angeles, both cities not fully recovered and both apprehensive about a recurrence before the year 2000. He saw the rebirth of religion in agnostic Soviet Russia, at a time when the churches were closed and Christianity was banned, and the deaths of Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy in office, though he, Casey, had passed on in 1945, 15 years before Kennedy's election. 30 years before they occurred, he foresaw the race riots that swept the country and which he said would be ongoing until the American people made an extra effort to care for each other. Pragmatically, as he saw how accurately his psychic observations define the past and the present, he came to believe in an endless cycle of life. Though he could consciously grieve for those who knew sorrow and pain in this lifetime, he felt there was a lesson to be learned that would be helpful the next time around. "Death is a beginning," he said, "a passing in and a passing out, not unlike the seasons and their changes." He so often said, as an axiom of life, "You get to heaven on the arm of the person you're helping." Casey did not have an easy time in a world where he made life so much easier for so many people. From childhood in Western Kentucky, a farmer's son, he was thought strange and shunned. A neighboring priest crossed the street when he approached Casey's house. Others laughed at him openly. He endured it all with the resignation of the biblical Job. He was only 4 years old when he showed the first signs of being the man he was to become. He had been sitting on a horse with his Confederate veteran grandfather when the horse, terrified by a bear, reared up and trampled its rider. The grandfather covered the boy with his body. At daybreak, a searching party, including the boy's parents and neighboring farmers, came to the scene. The boy's father, Leslie Casey, knelt and saw that his own father was dead. He turned to his wife, Carrie. "My pa's dead," he said. "He died saving the boy. The boy rubbed his eyes and said, "He's not dead, Pa. He's been talking to me. He says he's all right." Edgar's father winced in embarrassment, while the neighbors looked at each other and shrugged. As he grew up, he had visions of angels, particularly a lady in white who spoke to him when he was distressed. He dismissed these as idle dreams. He was slow in school, seeing visions of a mystical Atlantis, while younger classmates were learning about Columbus. He had no friends. He would go to his grandfather's grave for comfort and sit against a tree and nod off with an open Bible in his lap. As he dozed, he saw, as in a dream, the lady in white, who said he would do great things one day. "Do not despair. You will find your way, for the Lord makes wise the simple and enlightens his eyes." Only that morning the teacher had consigned him to a classroom corner to don a dunce cap. He had stood up and, with a dignity uncommon in one so young, walked out of the class. That night on the staircase, he overheard his father saying, "He's made us the town laughingstock. He couldn't even spell cabin in school today. He's impossible. He sees things that aren't there and hears voices nobody else does." Tears came to his eyes as he knelt that night to say his prayers. Through the mist of the tears, the lady in white reappeared. "What shall I do?" he asked the misty figure. "Sleep on the spelling book tonight, and you will be able to spell every word," she replied. He put the primer under his pillow that night. That morning, at breakfast, his father put him to a test. He not only spelled every word correctly, but he knew the page the words were on. The father tossed the spelling book away, thinking it a trick of some kind, while Edgar's mother hugged the 12-year-old boy and said, "Listen to your own heart and never doubt the Lord." The boy smiled. "It's not the Lord I doubt, Ma." Chapter 1. The Great New Planet Earth. Where is the safest place to live? A minister concerned about the approaching millennium asked Edgar Cayce. "Don't worry so much where you live, but how you live," the sage of Virginia Beach replied. "Make the family of man your family as well." It was an answer he gave the many, for his far-seeing psychic mind told him that when man raised his consciousness and mended his ways, loving his neighbor as he loved himself, the destruction he saw was not inevitable. Cayce had visualized the devastation of a power-drunk and greedy Atlantis, broken up in remnants in one day, and had feared the same would be visited on the great cities of this nation, the modern Atlantis, if it did not open its heart to the downtrodden and oppressed. "The Lord," he said, "marks the fall of the smallest sparrow. He knows how so many in authority treat the infirm and the aged. Look at the Napoleons, Caesars, and the like. Rather than casting themselves in God's image, they made gods of themselves and were destroyed." There would be some destruction. Earthquakes and volcanoes, violent ocean storms and global warming, predicted by Cayce decades ago, with shifts in the polar axis and powerful bursts of solar winds whipping into our atmosphere from various directions at a dazzling velocity of more than 20,000 miles a minute, bringing on the El Niño tidal wave and other climatic changes. He warned of the vanishing shield, the ozone layer, in the Earth's magnetic field, diminishing the protection from the damaging solar rays. He foresaw a death ray, a byproduct of laser research in America, with which ancient man eliminated the dinosaurs on Atlantis and our primitive Earth. He predicted the death ray would turn up on the Earth in some 25 years, and so it did, put together by scientists at the University of California Laboratory at Berkeley. It has not been activated. He saw dramatic extensions of human life, with centenarians commonplace, along with cures for Alzheimer's, cancer, and other malignant diseases of the aging. He visualized the genetic birth of new life, long before cloning became a popular word. Optimistically, modifying predictions of worldwide disasters, Casey saw a rising consciousness in man as the biblical end of times moved into the new millennium, marking the dawning of a new age, exalted by the presence of the one who had come before with the promise of everlasting life, and would be a light unto a new generation already affected by an increasing spirituality, as though the Christ influence was already here. He saw a burst of new ideas in communication, as though the secrets of Atlantis's advanced technologies, buried under the shifting ocean sands, had evolved out of minds that remembered that distant past. There will be new sources of energy, supplanting the poisonous gases from automobiles, trains, and smokestacks that annually pollute the air with endless tons of the toxic gases, carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide. Water, broken down into its component parts, hydrogen and oxygen, then electrified, will become the principal energy source. Light and heat will be drawn from the sun's rays, warming huge buildings and private homes in cities wholly sustained by their own power. Plagues, AIDS, will be eliminated, but not until tens of millions of lives have been lost around the world. There will be massive desalinization of Atlantic and Pacific coastal waters, bringing an end to droughts and famines on this continent, and new discoveries of other solar systems and new life. Like the prophets of old, Casey was concerned not only by what we humans thought of God, but by what he thought about us, and considered that his commandments could no longer be ignored before righteous retribution by cataclysmic strokes of nature. Inequities in the social order, said the fundamentalist Casey, were trying the Lord's patience. But redemption, though overdue, was still possible. There must be greater consideration of each individual, each soul being his brother's keeper. There will then come about political and economical relationships where there will be a leveling in society. For as the period draws near for the changes that come with the new order, it behooves idealistic individuals and groups to practice what they preach. Though the heavens and the earth pass away, my word will not pass away. And that word was, love thy neighbor as thyself. Casey's critics smiled, but the Virginia Beach soothsayer only sighed and renewed his warning. Unless his word of brotherhood is considered, there must eventually come a revolution in this country and wars between brothers. For these are the leveling means to which men resort when there is plenty in some areas and lack in others. Crime, riots, and every form of disturbance arise when those in authority do not consider every phase of human activity and experience. Despite many prophecies of doom and gloom by scientists as the millennium neared, the long-term future looked bright to Casey. The main thrust of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, war, death, pestilence, and famine, will be met by a convocation of nations establishing a permanent armed confederacy to keep the peace, lest a nuclear holocaust wipe out civilization as we know it. Whatever man has done, he can undo. Man is not ruled by the world, the earth, the environs about it, said Casey, nor the planetary influences with their associations and activities. Rather, man brings order out of chaos by his compliance with divine law. By his disregard of the law of divine influence, man brings chaos and destructive forces into his experience. For a less chaotic world, live by the Ten Commandments, with its love thy neighbor as thyself, and the Sermon on the Mount. Great upheavals in the earth may be brought about by violations of the divine law. Only then shall the forces of destruction take over within the bowels of the earth, as they have in the minds of men in wars that have taken millions of lives, born and unborn, and left great cities and nations in ruin. Casey was optimistic, while deploring the dissension in organized religion as a blot on man's conscience. More wars, more blood have been shed over racial and religious differences than anything else. But these differences will soon be mended. The author thought of this years later, as nearly a million Americans of every race and color, and Christians of every denomination, including Jews for Jesus, participated in a religious love fest at the nation's capital on the eve of the millennium. Blacks and whites from all over the country were trading handshakes and hugs as they praised the Lord. Casey had foreseen it all, in a promising era of benevolence and brotherhood. The end of the apocalyptic time, times and a half of the Bible, and the beginning of a new mind-opening age with the advent of Christ. Casey, toward the end of his life, spoke of Christ's presence as though it were already a reality in bettering man's relations with the Lord. With the advent of the Son of Man on the earth, giving man as an advocate of the Father, there will be an influence to counteract much of the retribution from misuse of the authority given governing the laws of the universe. As for the precise time, no one knows, even as he gave, only the Father. Until then, it would be a testing period, with God's children on probation in their little playpen. Casey saw the course of events with a telescopic eye. Back in the 1930s, he saw improbable allies join to beat back the Antichrist emblematic of an improbable Axis coalition of Germany, Japan, and Italy, thus preserving the global peace for the century. He was ridiculed when he saw communist Russia as the hub of this alliance, but he persevered. Atheistic Russia, freeing itself from the shackles of communist tyranny, will become the hope of the world, the sleeping prophet announced, to the chagrin of his own followers. Somewhat shaken himself, he gave additional readings which saw the democratizing of the Soviet Union, with the liberation of several Soviet states, and a friendship with the great enemy, America, saying a miracle from the skies would occur before this event took place. Nothing seemed more improbable at this time, when Stalin's Russia loomed as a global menace. Not until a nuclear accident rocked the town of Chernobyl in the Russian Ukraine on April 26, 1986. The physical impact was great, but the spiritual and emotional jolt was even greater. With millions of people affected by the nuclear fallout that swept across the skies of Soviet Union and Northern Europe, there were dark whispers among the tens of millions of Russian peasants that the tragedy was the Lord's retribution against a godless nation that had forsaken its ancient faith. Rumors that it was all in the Bible spread like wildfire through the land. Bibles were scarce in atheistic Russia, but a black market in the Holy Bible soon flourished behind the Iron Curtain. It is all in Revelation, God's promise of things to come, the peasants cried as they smuggled Bibles into their homes. And sure enough, it was. For the English word for Chernobyl was wormwood. And it was wormwood that presaged the evil to come in the destruction and fire spawned by God's wrath. An ominous passage in the prophetic book of Revelations sent a shiver through a population already terrified by the fallout casting a pall over Europe. And there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon a third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of water. And the name of the star was Wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were bitter. The Russians asked themselves what it meant that a third part of man would be killed by fire and smoke and by brimstone. They could visualize another Hiroshima, where the afflicted would pray for a death mercifully ending their agony and misery. And in those days shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. It got no better as they combed through the Bible. The prophet Jeremiah castigating leaders who walk in lies and strengthen the hands of the evildoers, as in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. Jehovah, will feed them with wormwood and make them drink of the water of gall. Just as he foresaw the Christianizing of Russia, Casey saw the most populous country on earth, China, gradually turning to Christ prior to any swarming of missionaries over the land. The Spirit came from within the country itself, as though the hand of God had touched them and said, "Listen to the wind." There were signs that appeared to support Casey's belief in a rising consciousness. Small things, perhaps, but nevertheless bellwethers of sweeping change. A golf game. Not that much in the tide of human affairs, but significant. As television replays showed an elite white gallery at a Georgia country club cheering on a youthful Tiger Woods over all white rivals as he went on to win a prestigious Masters tournament on a southern course where he wouldn't have been allowed a few years earlier. No less significant was Tiger Woods' acknowledgement of that victory on television when he was asked about blazing a trail for black people. "I am not black," he said in a statement that bothered some and inspired others. "Nor white, yellow, or brown, but a member of the human race." As Casey said so often, it was all in man's hands. In this instance, the hands of 21-year-old Tiger Woods, with his benign outlook, along with his golfing skills. "One man or 10, with their hearts graced by the Lord, can make a difference," said Casey. "For it is not the world, the earth, the environs about it, nor even the planetary influences that rule man." Geologists and seismologists were not as optimistic as Casey. The big one in California, bigger than the quake that demolished San Francisco in 1906, is yet to come, they say. "The question is not whether a giant earthquake is coming," said Dallas Peck of the U.S. Geological Survey, "but when and where." Wherever there has been a major earthquake, the geologists say, there will likely be another. California, rocked again by a frightening quake in the San Francisco area in 1989, can expect quakes of even greater magnitude within 10 or 15 years. The entire Mississippi Valley is threatened. The most likely area for the biggest big one is the basin of New Madrid, Missouri, south of St. Louis, where in 1811 to 1812, a series of quakes was powerful enough to rock 20 states and reverse the flow of the Mississippi. Tension has been building ever since in the New Madrid area, and it could erupt at any time, geologist Dallas Peck has warned. A catastrophe, such as the one that killed 10,000 in Iran recently and 800,000 in China, is inevitable. Even in a fault-ridden Manhattan, amid all the skyscrapers reaching proudly into the sky. Not unlike Casey, a Caltech seismologist was aware of the natural forces that are working slowly but inexorably under the earth, out of sight, unnoticed, setting off reactions and counter-reactions in fragile earth faults deep in the bowels of the earth. There was no reliable way, despite all the scientific research, to predict them, except for the behavior patterns of animals trying to escape the doomed area. Nobody but the horses, dogs, birds, fish, rats, and cockroaches fleeing their forest or city homes seem to know with certainty when a trembler is about to strike, and then, alas, only a few hours before the event. In Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, the day before a major quake, the forest became silent, and visitors wondered at the absence of the chirping birds. They didn't wonder long. 24 hours later, a devastating, life-threatening quake shook the wild nature preserve, uprooting trees and buildings and causing widespread damage, showing some primal connection between animal life, closer to nature than man, and the natural forces brimming under the surface of the earth and its heavens. Edgar Casey saw the sun, the center of our solar system, as God's gift of life. The sun, as ruler, has a direct effect on the inhabitants of the earth, as well as its plants and minerals. The sun reflects those inner turmoils with its sunspots and solar winds that stir people's emotions, earthquakes, and wars around the world. The sunspots are but a natural consequence of that turmoil inside man, which, with love for the Lord, predisposes him to a sunny nature. Know that the mind is the builder. A spot, a blot on the life-giving sun, or a burst of radiant light given unto those who dwell in darkness and cry aloud to the Lord for courage and hope. Courage and hope. Qualities that were Edgar Cayce's during his rocky journey through life. Early on, he was mocked and laughed at by scientists and educators who never studied his gift. Impossible, they said. No man can do what he claims, healing people without seeing them, prescribing remedies that no self-respecting doctor would even know about. He was not even dismissed as a quack. He was a freak. The elderly dean of the Virginia Beach Medical Fraternity, Robert Woodhouse, approached by a delegation of younger physicians, was asked to bring charges of practicing medicine without a license against Cayce. He laughed. You fellows don't get it. This man isn't practicing medicine. He comes to me, and my wife goes to him. Cayce was in a sphere all his own. He was able to simplify the immensity of a boundless heaven where a sun, thousands of times the size of our Earth, was in turn dwarfed by a star in another solar system, thousands of times larger than our sun. As a child of God's universe, cast in God's image, man should be aware, Cayce said, of life-giving interchange of cosmic rays between the planets, notably the sun, and the Earth with its spark of human life. The great scientists, Einstein, Copernicus, and Galileo, divinely inspired like Cayce, were very much like him, affirming our connection to God's infinite world. The more you become aware of your relationship to the universe, Cayce said on many occasions, the greater your ability to apply the God force within you, and still greater your responsibility toward your fellow. For as you do to the least of men, you do to a sun which reflects the turmoils in man, stirring up earthquakes and wars. He asked listeners to look into themselves and not think of the sun as the ruler of the earth, but of the Lord as the ruler of the sun, and as mindful of its welfare as he is of man's. For one could not exist without the other. If you wish the ruler of the earth, the sun, to hearken to the voice of that power which created it and give it light, you should realize that the solar body with its sunspots so often reflects the discord in your life and your responsibility to your fellow man. For as you do unto others, so you do unto your God. The changes Cayce saw in the earth seemed to have taken on a new vibration. Not surprising, since the earth and its sister planets never stay still. They are always moving, and with movement there is always change. Cayce said we should look on these celestial bodies as our friends, for they keep us in touch with our universe. We must think positive. And where earthquakes are concerned, keep from expecting the big one of the doom and gloomers momentarily. It doesn't have to happen, said Cayce. Just keep the earth slate clear, so God doesn't have to wipe it clean. Cayce's predictions weren't so much about earthquakes. Where some saw a disaster, he saw a new world born, with the bright promise of a dawning Aquarian age, which rests on God's gift of free will, the only one of his creatures so blessed. Our experiences are changeable, open to choice, as we let the Creator come into our sphere, said Cayce. As we get to know our Earth better, with all its ups and downs, men will come to the realization we are all part of the same family and have a collective destiny. So we may as well enjoy it, peering into a far better world than we have known before. Chapter 2. The Second Coming. Jesus of Galilee was Edgar Cayce's companion. Cayce thought of him as his guide. For one who turned daily to the Bible, this was a very personal connection. Jesus came to Casey in both his waking and sleeping hours, sometimes in visions and often in dreams. As a boy, so much by himself, Casey saw Jesus in his robe and sandals, treading through narrow streets, the sick holding out their hands in supplication. He saw Jesus reach out and touch a leper as the motley crowd shuddered. And all cried out in wonder as the afflicted man stooped and kissed the hem of Jesus' robe and sobbed, "I have felt the hand of God." As a boy, Casey never mentioned any of this to anyone. It seemed so natural to him. For the Bible moved graphically through his mind, and Jesus seemed like an old friend. He walked with him as he trod the sacred ground of Jerusalem with his apostles. It was not surprising that Jesus would appear to him in the approaching millennium, more often than not in the quiet hours of the night when Casey slipped into the dream state. One dream was so special, so sharply defined, that Casey, as a young man, shared it with friends who had gathered around, knowing from the look in Casey's eyes that he had something unusual to impart. They listened avidly as he spoke of his dream. It had come unbidden, and it had held him enthralled. His friends were struck by the glow on his usually placid face. It was a dream he would always remember, as would his listeners. "It was 3 o'clock in the morning," he said. "I could see the hands of a clock in my dream. A man came to me, someone I had never seen before, and said, 'Do you want to go to a meeting?' I said, 'I don't know. I don't go out very much.' This person then said to me, 'This is a very unusual meeting. I think you will enjoy it.' I asked, 'Who is going to be there?' 'The Master is going to speak.' We went to the meeting. It was in the most beautiful place I have ever seen. We entered a long hallway. The light was a dark blue, opalescent, and made our flesh look purple. As I looked around, I realized that all of the people there had passed over. No one was there in the flesh except myself. There was a man with a halo about him I took for Jesus. I didn't know the person who had asked me to come. Those around me were mostly preachers, the Reverend Dwight Moody, an evangelist, and others I could not name. There was a light. I couldn't see it, but realized in the odd way of dreams that it came from an unseen voice. There were no benches or chairs. Everyone was standing, dressed in robes. It was the Lord speaking. He was not visible. 'Who will go to bring peace to the earth?' Jesus, who had been standing near me, stepped forward and said, 'I will go. It is time for me to go again onto the earth, though there will come forth from our friend here,' referring to me, 'a messenger that will proclaim my day.' 'When and where?' the dreamer asked. The voice, the Lord, replied, 'In the hearts and minds of those who set themselves up to be a channel in the purpose and desires of that physical body. As has been given of old in the Bible, the sun will be darkened, and the earth shall be broken up in many places. And then shall he be proclaimed through the spiritual interception in the hearts and minds and souls of those who have sought his way. His star will appear and will point the way for them to enter into the Holy of Holies within themselves.' The time was not clear to some, and Casey elaborated. 'There will be the upheavals in the Arctic and the Antarctic that will make for the eruption of volcanoes in the torrid areas, and there will be shifting then of the poles, so that where there has been those of a frigid or the semi-tropical will become the more tropical, and moss and fern will grow. And these will begin in 1998, heralded as the time when his light will be seen again in the clouds. As to seasons, as to places, it is given to those who have named the name and who bear the mark of his calling and his election in their bodies. To them shall it be given. Casey was speaking of a few chosen by the Lord to mark Christ's resurrection in the new millennium. They had listened, entranced. "Please explain," said one. "What is meant by he will walk and talk with men of every clime?" Casey replied, eyeing each person. "As given, for 1,000 years with men everywhere, then in groups, in masses, and then the first resurrection in 1,000 years, when the changes will come." In the searching out of those who, where, and when he speaks or has spoken among, "By their fruits you shall know them, they that bring more righteousness, the children of faith, hope, and charity, those of the Spirit, the channel that may walk with him. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid, giving self to seeking day by day to know the will of the Father as manifest in him, and may be manifest in you. For he will not leave you, but will come to you, but only if invited, as when he walked with men as the master among men." There were still some puzzled frowns. "Always with the will of the Father. He walked and talked with men in the various stages of development through the ages. Even as Joseph in the land of Egypt, when those of that land were giving counsel to many nations." Another hand went up. "How will we know him?" "Perfected in body. Overshadowing the ordinary figure of man, he will make himself known. Just as the various developments of man through the ages have been noted at those times when he walked and talked with men without their feeling any more than his presence." He paused and looked around. There was the ghost of a smile on his lips. "He tarries not, and the time draws near." He had returned before in spirit, in times of crisis, infusing his will at the peace conference in Geneva at the end of World War I, into the heart and soul and veins of one not considered an unusually godly man, President Woodrow Wilson. Yet Wilson was raised to be a channel for the world. And so was born a League of Nations, the gift of the Christ, Casey was saying, though its leaders, as Casey saw, were not dedicated enough to maintain the peace when the League was swept up by World War II. A strict fundamentalist, Casey was baffled when he gave his first reading concerning reincarnation. He was appalled as the reading was read back to him. But as he fell back on his Bible, he read about the apostles asking Christ whether he had been the prophet Elijah in a past life. Christ replied that it was not he, but John the Baptist. There were other biblical references of reincarnation by Christ, such as, "Before Abraham was I am." How, they asked, could he precede Abraham when he was no more than 30 years on the planet? But gradually, going over what Jesus said, reincarnation seemed to make sense. In his lifetime, Casey had met many people he felt he had known before, liking some at sight, others raising the hackles on the back of his neck. He remembered the places and events that checked out. His saving the life of a young boy on a riverboat who later jumped up into Casey's lap as he recalled the experience. He could visualize treading the streets of the old city with the Savior and his followers, and how thrilled he had been. Was it his imagination? Yet even his imagination, it had to come out of something. Was this why, as a boy, he had clung to the Bible, not skipping through it as some did, but burying his nose in a book whose pages had become ragged with use? He had particularly liked the red ink, not only because it was the word of Christ, but because it represented the blood he had given for God and mankind. He recalled the apostles asking Jesus whether a blind man he had helped had been born blind because he or his parents had sinned, indicating they were thinking in terms of a previous life and its karma. Jesus had replied that the works of God might be made manifest in him, the question implying reincarnation more than a response. It was obvious to Casey, or anyone who could read, that the disciples believed in reincarnation, which did not necessarily make it so, but did give some indication of the belief system of the early Christians. Who, thought Casey, could be more Christian than the disciples or the Master? Consequently, he breathed easier whenever his readings got into past lives. If it was good enough for Jesus and his 12 apostles, he told Gertrude, his wife and aide, it's good enough for me. He told friends on another occasion that they were witnessing a new dawn. With a worldwide need for a reassuring message from Jesus at a time when Casey foresaw missiles weighted with atomic bombs traveling with the speed of thought to any objective. In his millennium, there was a looking forward to the coming of the Messiah. Today, there is an expectation of the Prince of Peace. As he was sent before, and will be gladly received again, by those who know him by this light. You have already seen him in spirit, Casey said of the second coming. He sat still for hours, his hands folded, waiting for the Christ spirit to visit him. It seemed for a moment almost as though he could reach out and touch him. He remembered something said about helping Jesus to warn the people. Was this his purpose in life? Or was he just deceiving himself out of vanity and ego, two faults that marched together, each feeding on the other? No, he could not deceive himself, for then he would be deceiving others and be false to Christ, he thought. The words spilled out of him. His voice, usually gentle, vibrated across the room. Unconsciously, he slipped into biblical cadence. You have seen his spirit in the leaders of all realms of activity, in the isles of the sea, the wilderness, the mountains, in the activities of every race. For what must be obliterated? Hate, prejudice, selfishness, backbiting, unkindness, anger, passion, and those things of the mire, slime that are created in the activities of man. Is he coming today in the earth? Yes, in those who cry unto him from every corner. For he is the Son of Light, of God, and he comes again in the hearts and souls and minds of those who seek to know his ways. This is hard to understand by those mired in the flesh, where avarice and vice hold sway. Yet those who call on him will not go empty-handed, for he is the Spirit of God and his messenger. The hands went up. Will he return with his disciples? Will Peter, who rejected him, or Judas, who betrayed him for 30 pieces of silver? Casey, almost in sorrow, shook his head. What did he stand for? Forgiveness and love. He later embraced Peter. And what did Peter do? He founded a church in Christ's name. And Judas, the arch scoundrel of history? He is to be pitied. There was no one more prophetic than the Master. How else could he have done what he did? When he tossed the sop across the table at the Last Supper, and it stopped at Judas's place, he already knew what his trial was to be. And as he told John, the beloved, he went to the cross with the love of the Father to show that life was everlasting. For this my Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. Casey's eyes traveled around the room. He could see that some were confused. You wonder how you will know when he returns. That answer lies within you, for he is not only the light to the flock that follow him, but to those everywhere in need. His promise has ever been, if you will open thy heart, thy mind, I will enter, and abide with thee. The day of miracles was not past, for Casey was proof of that. There were few in the group now listening to him whom he had not healed in mind, body, and soul. He knew how much depended on their faith, already weakened by misfortune or illness. He urged his listeners to visualize their dreams. With these dreams of the Master, he confided, has come a strength when I feared I had not the will to go on. I am still a bit dazed each time the assurance comes, and fearful. Like so many blessed by his presence and have turned the good, this strength, into self-serving purposes. When that remembered voice again asked, who will warn my people? I boldly volunteered. Then out of a throng came the Master, Jesus. He blessed me and said, I will go with you all the way. Casey smiled. I was ready then. Even giving a dozen readings during a day when his own readings told him he should do no more than two for his own health's sake. But with his two sons overseas in a bloody war, he could not deny others whose pain he felt. While his dreams often seemed unreal and self-delusionary, they gave him the hope he needed to summon the strength to help himself and others. I regretted that I didn't have this depth earlier. It gave me new assurance that God is mindful of the children of men, responsive to their prayers, directly or through Christ. In a world of uncertainties, our only link to the Lord was our vision of Christ. As before, Jesus was to have his forerunner, said Casey. John, the beloved of Christ, who always sat by his side. There is soon to come into the world a body that to many has been representative of a sect, a thought, of a philosophy. Yet one beloved of all men in all places, where the university of God in the earth has all been proclaimed. There the oneness of the Father is known and is magnified in the activities of the individuals who will proclaim the rising day of the Lord. Hence that one John, the beloved, in the earth. His name shall again be John. You ask where and when is to be his one? In the hearts and minds of those that have set themselves in that position that they become channel through which spiritual, mental, and material things become one in the purpose and desire of that physical body. Beginning the new age of spiritual awakening. As to the spiritual changes that are to be as an omen, as a sign to those that this is shortly to come to pass, as has been given of old, Matthew, the sun will be darkened, and the earth shall be broken up in many places, and then shall be proclaimed through the spiritual interception in the hearts, minds, and souls of those who have sought his way, that his star has appeared, and will point the way for those who enter into the Holy of Holies in themselves. As Casey aged, and his connection to the earth became tenuous, his dreams about the Master were more frequent. In one dream, as heartwarming as any he experienced, he appeared to have been invited to an evangelical meeting by two ministers whom he had met but once. They took him to a large revival meeting. The tent was crowded, and the air teemed with expectation. There was a large screen that took up one side of the tent, and flashes of lightning in the distant background. Through the open flaps in the tent, Casey could make out a great white cloud that seemed to dominate the heavens. He asked one of the ministers what the meeting was about. The minister looked at him in surprise. You don't know? Casey shook his head. The Lord our God is about to speak. At this point, a voice, clear and strong, resonated out of the cloud and lightning, saying, Who will warn my children? As if in response, the Master emerged from out of the throng, clad in a simple robe and sandals, saying in a strong voice, I will warn my brethren. The Lord then spoke in a voice that made the tent tremble, addressing the Master. No, not now. The time is not yet fulfilled for you to return to the place you were. So who shall warn my children? One of the ministers spoke up. Why not send Casey? He is here now and ready. The master nodded. Father, Casey will warn my brethren. There was a vast silence, and then a thunderous chorus of eager voices from the assembly. And we will help Casey, came the cry. Casey could see the smile on the master's face, and the dream closed down. He was puzzled and concerned, troubled. How could he live up to his dream? Chapter 3. Money for the Millennium. He made more millionaires than the runaway stock market of the 1990s, and he was more versatile. Clients came to him for all manner of financial advice, making their fortunes in real estate, business ventures, the stock market, and the racetrack. And yet he lived and died poor because he wouldn't use his psychic powers to make money for himself. He saw nothing wrong about people making money with his readings, as long as they did it for others. Supporting the family, getting a son or daughter an education, buying a home, or giving to the less fortunate. He was big on homes, since he was a long time acquiring one, thinking that he would lose his gift if he misused it to help himself. He saw the country becoming the world's financial center by the millennium, and his only fear was that the quest for money would exceed the search for God. Sooner or later, we will understand that the biblical story of our Creator was no fable. For God, as we will see one day, is creation itself. This takes in every planet in our solar system and other systems. He listens to the smallest voice. He is a universal spirit that Jesus fathomed, and where he gained his strength, the strength to live and to die, to ultimately show life was everlasting. Casey didn't negate the value of money, only the love of it. Jesus drove the money changers out of the temple because their greed was an offense to the Lord. He deplored the gulf between the rich and the poor and preached that things had to be evened up. Casey lived penuriously most of his life, when he could easily have been independently wealthy. Those close to him had the feeling that he felt an affinity for Jesus, who never owned more than a robe and a pair of sandals. No one resisted great wealth more cheerfully. When he turned down a Hollywood offer for $500,000 to check out their scripts, he told a studio boss, "I'm not that big a star." I couldn't believe he turned it down, the film mogul said, when he was doing so many readings that helped people get rich without charging them a dime. What he didn't realize was that Casey, with his special vision, was doing what he could to instill a love of his fellow man into others that would forestall the global problems he had foreseen with the millennium. Feeling as he did that the violence erupting under the earth was a reflection of the hostility and greed on the surface. He saw hard times, and he saw good times. He knew when it was time to invest and time to keep your money in the bank or under a pillow. The advice he gave, money-wise, was invariably in response to questions about a certain stock, business, or property. He often wondered whether he had been drawn to Virginia Beach, Virginia, then a sleepy little resort, from Selma, Alabama, because of a premonition that the real estate boom was coming in the beach city and he could help friends profit from it. Casey downplayed his influence on the real estate market. People are certainly going wild on Virginia Beach property. I don't know whether it's because we came here from Selma, Alabama, or whether we came down from Selma because of what it was going to be. According to a reading we gave on real estate this afternoon, property here is going to advance the next few years from 50% to 1,000%. So if you invested $1,000, the best price would be $1,000,000. Unbelievable, but true. There will be many new millionaires. The price is constantly increasing. I can only hope they spend their millennium money wisely and think of the next man. As Casey saw, the residential values to the north of Laskin Road were worth 4 or 5 times those to the south. An NBC reporter, impressed with Casey's predictions of the city's growth, dubbed him this marvelous man who had knowledge possessed by no other human being. He pointed out that Casey didn't go to Virginia Beach until the latter part of his life, going there because one of his readings said that's where he should settle. When he decided to move, he knew nothing about the town and had never seen it. The name had come to him out of the blue, like his predictions. He and his family were disappointed to see the sleepy little fishing village near Norfolk. But since other people followed his readings, Casey thought he should too, and there he settled.